Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line Podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, but I'm party.
And Jake Latondras.
And bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line Podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur in the Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi. Of course, it's Friday. Spence, it is warming up, man. Summer is coming on quick.
Yes, sir, it is. How are you today, Rocky?
I am doing great. I'm doing
great. Do I sound like a professional? I'd be lying if I said I didn't kind of feel like a professional. I don't know how Rob does Mondays with Rob without a set of these headphones. But I feel like I've been endorsed by some Chinese headphone company or something. I mean, this is incredible. It's like a whole new world.
So Spence called me. Spence is going to be joining the show a lot more. Spencer's going to take over along with me and Josh and Jake. But Spence is going to be coming on and helping co-host some of the stuff in the future. And I said, Spence, you know, between you driving and smush phone in the face and then trying to hold it up on speaker, I said, you got to wear some headphones. Here's the link. And you got those in. You sound great. Dude, you sound unbelievable.
I drove all across Fayette County looking for the little adapter from a quarter inch jack to the whatever they call the iPhone flat thing, like the Lightning or whatever they call that thing. It's they don't have
Lightning
those
jack.
Dollar General in Bolivar or White Bull or So.
Yeah, Walmart or the actual cell phone store are the only people that sell them.
Yeah, well, we don't have a cell phone store in the whole county, so you have to go to Memphis. But I did find one at Walmart, so we're good.
All right. Good. Look, before we get in the story, I got to talk about the video when you got back from Colorado last week. You're a smart man by taking Black Betty to the airport. I've got to give it to you on that, but the security measures that you put in place to make sure Black Betty doesn't get stolen that's first class, man. That is first class stuff.
Yeah, I mean it. Well, there's a story behind that. There's a new Black Betty. And I hadn't decided whether I'm going to call her Black Betty Jr. or just all lowercase b's. But she went on the trip to South Carolina with us 2 weeks ago, and she didn't make it home. She's still at Jones Chevrolet in Sumter, South Carolina. So Black Betty is back off the injured reserve, partially retired. She's been fully activated, and she's driving every day. And something I learned when I first put her on the partially disabled or partially retired list, I learned real quick that there's something electronically in Black Betty that's drawing down the power. Because if you let her sit for like 3 days, it kills both batteries. And first I just thought, you know, old batteries, I needed to get new ones. But I got them checked out, and they both work. It just when it sits there, you know, over time it draws it down. So I either got to start her every day or disconnect the battery cables. And so since the new version of Black Betty is in South Carolina and I had to go to the airport and fly out, I live an hour from the airport, and my plane last Monday flew out at 6:55 in the morning, and Miss Lindy said, I don't know how you expect to get to the airport. She said, I love you, but I am not leaving this house at 3 o'clock in the morning to drive you to the airport. You're going to have to walk or something. So I thought, I had to think about it for a minute and thought, well, if I can get myself there, but I'm not going to get home because it's going to be dead. And I thought, well, you know, if I just disconnect the battery cables, I'll be good. So I left the door unlocked, all four of the doors unlocked. In fact, I left the driver's side door actually open because the handle doesn't work, and I left all four batteries, both of the two batteries disconnected for a week while we were in Nebraska and Colorado, and nobody messed with her. So
I'm sorry. What's the story with the door handle?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and now I've actually, another little secret about the door handle. The door handle is so annoying, it's ridiculous. And I need to get it fixed, but I just can't ever get the batteries charged on the same day that I have a second vehicle to get it to the body shop and get it taken apart and all this. Well, so anyways, a buddy of mine came by the other day and he brought me one of those little, you know, those little, airbags. It's like 6x6 square that you inflate like the guys use to unlock your truck. So I just have one of those in the truck box because if you pull in somewhere, sometimes when you put it in park, it doesn't do the automatic unlock. And so if you get out and turn the truck off and slam the driver's side door, like you're locked out of the vehicle because the driver's side door doesn't work. And if the automatic unlock thing doesn't engage when you put it in park, I mean, you're screwed. So, my buddy brought me one of those little air bladder things that you jimmy the door with, and I've got a piece of flat bar back there in the truck. So I've accidentally locked myself out probably, I don't know, 7 or 8 times in the last week. But I can break in it pretty quick.
Was it Dawson or was it Criswell telling me that she had a strap going from the four-wheel drive to the door to hold it closed? Was that somebody else's truck? Am I mistaken on that one?
That's somebody else's. All four of my doors work. They just, from the inside, they just don't work from the outside. The driver's side door don't work from the outside. I don't know who that is. And I've got electronic four-wheel drive shift that works great on this truck. I mean, I give this truck she gets a bad rap for all the little things that are wrong with her. But, man, for 413,000 miles, she's a dang tank. And everything works on her. I mean, I had her in four-wheel drive yesterday. The only thing that really doesn't work is the driver's door, the rear passenger side window. And it would work. It just came off the pulley system while we were in Canada, and we couldn't fix it, so we just put a set screw in it, like a sheet, you know, a self-tapping sheet metal screw, and just kind of fixed it in the upright position so that we didn't have to drive all the way home with it, the window hissing back there, and the heated seats. Those are literally the only three things of any significance that don't work on this truck. So,
all right, so when it comes to automobiles, it sounds mm-hmm. Sounds like you and I think a lot alike. I look at a vehicle as getting me from point A to point B. It serves a purpose. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah.
A vehicle does not define who I am. As long as it mechanically serves its purpose, I don't care what the crap it looks like. Mine's beat to hell and back. The silver bullet's mm-hmm. what I call mine.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody mm-hmm. went to a T-ball game yesterday. This guy that he's assistant coach, and he's a real estate agent. He and I've got to be friends here in Oxford. And he said, "Saw you passing through town, man." I said, "Yeah, you can't miss my truck coming through Oxford. You know, everybody around here's in their new Land
Cruiser. Got a nice vehicle, right?
Yeah, 2019 GMC with the new tailgate. Man, he started laughing in my truck. It's just a, you know, what does it matter? I kind of just think of vehicles kind of like the old days. It's my horse. Gets me from A to B. That's it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and listen, when the new little Black Betty left us stranded in Sumter, South Carolina, you better believe the first thing out of Jared's mouth was, Black Betty wouldn't have left us like this. And I said, you know what? You're dang right. She wouldn't have. She never did. She never will. I mean, maybe she will one day, but, I mean, they just don't make them like they used to. And I don't know. Part of me wishes I'd have never bought the new one, but it is awful comfortable. It's quiet. It's nice to have that Bluetooth radio and all that. I mean, all that stuff's pretty swanky. So I don't know.
Do you think it's a stage that everybody goes through in life that
I mean, I don't know, Rocky. I think it's kind of like, how do you define your life? You know, I mean, my vehicles are a lot like my clothes. Lindy gives me a hard time because my favorite pair of pants are those Blue Mountain $14.99 ones on the end cap at Tractor Supply, and they're like my waist and length size. They're like, you know, the legs at the bottom of the legs, they're like 12 inches wide, and they're high water kind of. And, you know, Lindy's like, man, you just look awful in those pants. And I'm like, babe, who is looking at me? Who cares? You know, who really cares? Like, who looks at me and says, oh my gosh, that guy's pants are too wide at the bottom. You know, I mean, like, it don't matter. It just really, and she's always like, why do you want them short like that? And I'm like, who likes to step on the back of their pants? Like, I would take, if you buy them the right length where they, you know, kind of roll up there at the bottom, I just take some scissors and cut them off because I don't want to step on them. That's your pants are just to keep your legs covered. They're not to be walked on. But, you know, everybody's got a different agenda in life. And so.
Yeah, but look, you can step on your pants wrong if they're too long, and it's almost like stepping on a rock and you get one of those stone bruises. If you hit that part where right there where they join, where they seam them together, and you hit that on the very bottom part, it's thicker. Oh man, it hurts.
Or if you're top heavy like we are, I mean, you just, you know, turn into Humpty Dumpty in a hurry. I mean, that's a good way to hit the ground. You start stepping on your britches legs. Anyways,
I got to tell this though, before we jump back into the story real quick, I want to say this. So Dawson was here yesterday, and I had more fun listening to Dawson talk about Tripp. You know, he asked me. He said, "Have you ever been around Tripp?" I said, "No, I've yet," because Dawson filmed my kids for a promo video for the clinic, trying to get it kickstarted off the ground. And Dawson brings up Tripp. He said, have you ever met Tripp? And I said, no, I hadn't met him yet. And I said, you know, what's he like? Is he like what you see, you know, on social media when Spencer does make a post about him? He said, he's like that and more. He said, you're going to see him in, he's going to be in overalls, and he's always respectful. He'd eat up with hunting. And you can correct me when I go wrong on this, but and Dawson was saying the last time that he was at your house, Spence, that Tripp came in while you and y'all were having a conversation, and he said, "Hey, I'm going across the street to help the neighbors pick up sticks in their yard, either unload firewood or something."
Yeah.
Hey, you don't find a kid like that anymore.
He wants to be a farmer real bad. He's eat up with bottomland camouflage, and he's learned how to, I mean, I hadn't taught him this. I know people won't believe that, but he's learned what the logos mean and the difference between real tree and mossy oak he has like four outfits top to bottom, and he pretty much rotates them through. And he wears camo top to bottom probably 3 or 4 days a week, depending on how dirty his clothes are. He does love overalls. but he only has one pair right now that fit him because he kind of hit a growth spurt. But and his class is so funny, man. His little class in first grade, there's 17 kids in his class and 16 in the other. In his class, there's 12 boys and 5 girls. In the other class, there's 11 boys and 5 girls. So there's 23 boys in first grade at Fayette Academy and 10 girls. And, wow. I mean, they are as redneck can get. Every one of them wears cowboy boots or rubber knee highs every day to school. And so much so that their teacher, her name is Miss Linda Gale, and she's been teaching at Fayette Academy in first grade for almost 40 years. She's taught, there's 4 kids in Tripp's class. She's taught their parents and went to school with their grandparents. So, I mean, you're talking about like a third generation first grade teacher here. But she, this year, first time in Fayette Academy history, she put a pro boy boots and rubber knee highs because she was tired of hearing those boys clank back and forth to the bathroom. And she just said, no more. And she said, if y'all push it, no more camouflage. And I said, Miss Linda Gale, you got some power, but you don't have that much power. Don't make me take this to the board. She said, I just don't understand why it's so important to them. And I said, well, you know, I mean, it just is. Like, let it be. It's a good thing. There could be.
They're being boys.
There's worse things for them to be, you know, opinionated about. And, I mean, my gracious, we live in a world where we wait on children to decide what gender they are. And, by gosh, I think the good Lord determined what gender they were before they were born. So, I mean, if those boys want to wear cowboy boots, I don't know what. You have to come up with a better reason that you don't want them to wear them than just you don't like hearing them clank up and down the hallway. So I went to battle and won that one. But
yeah, I'll tell you this, Dalton was talking about the video that y'all just released, the webisode with the turkey hunt.
Yeah,
really cool. Really cool webisode. And while this is being filmed,
one of the coolest things about that episode that was hard to really convey in that episode, but you'll start to see it here in the next few days, is so we got I think we started with 11 kids is what we thought we had. A couple of them, one of them ended up not being able to make it, and another one plans changed and he hunted but didn't actually make it, you know, to the event. But we ended up filming 9 kids. And I got 9 cameramen, and they all donated their time. And each kid left and got a, you know, in addition to all this stuff they got from these sponsors, they also got a short video of themselves and of their hunt. And so, I mean, for these kids, not only was the gear cool, but, I mean, can you imagine 9 kids that thought they were movie stars? Each one of them had a cameraman, and so, like, the first thing when they got there, like, we had a meeting that afternoon around lunchtime, and I assigned each one of the cameramen, told them who the parent was they were going to be working with and who the kid was they were going to be working with. And then some of them, if the dad wasn't wasn't much of a turkey hunter or whatever, we sent them with somebody who could yelp up a turkey. And so each camera guy knew what they were dealing with, a parent, a kid, and maybe a guide or an extra. And so their job was for that evening and the next day and Sunday morning, if their kid was going to hunt those, you know, both days, was to make a movie about, you know, their kid, just a short 3-minute thing. And then we're going to take all that footage and put it together into the episode that you see that we published Monday. But all that being said, I've got 9 separate videos of 9 kids who went on a turkey hunt, and those kids, man, they like, they're so proud of that. You can't even imagine how excited it makes a kid when they see themselves on a screen. You know, they don't think about TV like we do. They think about YouTube for kids or, you know, whatever they've seen on the tablet. And here they are, man, they're rock stars now. Slow motion, music, and they loved it. So it's pretty cool. Pretty cool. A lot of talented guys involved in all that.
Y'all had convinced Tripp that Dawson was his stepbrother.
Yeah. It's really my girls that think Dawson's a stepbrother. Tripp's not sure about the cameras. He likes Dawson okay, and he likes Dylan okay, but he's not crazy about them putting the camera in his face, and he's a lot more colorful off camera than he is on camera. And he's colorful now. I mean, he's very witty, and he's really, really sharp. He kind of thinks like an engineer, how things are designed. Like when he was really little, maybe four, I took him and showed him Bradley Moore's gin, cotton gin, and he came back and he basically built this incredible replica of the gin out of these like oversized Lincoln log kind of thingamajig. I mean, they're like giant Lego sort of things, but I mean, he built it complete with the press and everything. I sent it to Bradley and he goes, dude, that is unbelievable. He said, and they printed it out and hung it at the gin, said, sometimes I need these guys to know what a gin's actually supposed to look like. But that's Tripp. He's always thinking.
We're as a culture, leave it at this, as a culture, we are minimizing being a boy and what we were created to be. The media,
man, take that one step further, Rocky. We've minimized what it means to be a man. I mean, we've got 20,000 people on the Duck South page, and no offense to any of them, but I'd be ventured to say that half of them don't know. If you said, what does it mean to be a man in the United States of America? What does it mean to be an American man, a contributing member of society? A bunch of them know. A bunch of them would struggle. I mean, a lot of human men in America don't grow up with a male role model and a mentor of any kind. And, you know, I mean, not only are we losing hunters, truth of the matter is we're losing dads. We're losing, you know, we're broken homes. You know, I mean, I'm not trying to get preachy, but we've been taught, we've been beat up in American business society to the point that it's like being a white male is somehow like you've right out of the gate, you're kind of almost at a disadvantage. I mean, you're not at a disadvantage. That's not really fair to say to the minority categories, but it's against the rules to be proud of being a white middle-aged man, you know, that's not cool anymore. You can't be proud of being a dad.
I challenge this to you. You find me a show that comes on network TV, and the white male, if there's a white male main character from kid mm-hmm. shows all the way up to adult mm-hmm. shows,
yeah, this is the backbone. Never be. Yeah.
Yeah, this is how we're ingrained. But I challenge you to send me a message with a show where the white male from children's shows, like I said, to adult shows, is either the hero or the intelligent guy in that show.
He never is. Yeah, he's the bumbling idiot.
Yeah, exactly. The old Al Bundy effect, man. That's where it kind of all started, if you look back on it.
Yep, you're right. You're right. And I don't mean that, I hate to even have to say this disclaimer, but I don't mean that as a slight toward any minority groups or towards women. But, I mean, we all, it's like we were talking about the other day, we all have an obligation to be the best us. And you can tell me all you want to about Black History Month or women's movement or whatever, and neither one of those things, I can't be a black male. I can't be a middle-aged woman. I can only be a white middle-aged man because that's who I am. You can only be one thing, you know. You can only be you. And I don't know. We've been kind of beat up by society to sort of just keep that, hold that card under our vest, you know. Just don't be proud of that, you know. Let's celebrate everybody else, but don't celebrate you. Don't celebrate being the best you, you know. Oh well.
Oh, I agree. All right, so last week, where we left it,
you'd had a conversation mm-hmm. with Lee. You're taking him on a snow goose hunt. He had had a conversation with you about taking the footage that you had, taking it to social media. Dylan had gone on a hunt with you. You brought on another cameraman and Dylan, and you had gone to South Dakota.
Yeah, well, we really hadn't actually brought Dylan on yet. Where we left it was, I'd had this conversation with Lee, and basically Lee's advice was, whatever you do, just be in control of it, be in charge, you know, be a boss, and take control. Don't expect somebody else to control your destiny. Don't expect for somebody else to just make stuff happen for you. You got to grab the bull by the horns and go do it. So I took that advice, thought about it post SHOT Show, and it was becoming very apparent that the money was not there for a television show. And really what put me over the top about a television show was a buddy of mine said to me, I mean, think about it this way, since he said, if it's going to cost you $300,000 to do a television show, and let's just say you could raise that. He said, what if you couldn't raise that and you had to sell duck calls to get there? He said, you know, would you want to sell enough duck calls to pay for a $300,000 marketing project and just break even? Like, would that be worth it to you? And I said, hell no. You know, no, I don't want to do that. If I'm going to sell $300,000 worth of duck calls, I need to make a reasonable return on, you know, on my sales. I need to make a net profit. And so I took all those things, and then kind of at the same time, I needed a second cameraman for this trip that Josh and I were going on out west. And I called Dylan, and he was like, man, it's finals week or something. He had something at school. And he said, I might be able to miss. He asked his teacher. His teacher said, you're going to have to get a written job offer from this company in order for me to give you permission to miss. So I gave him a job offer. We went on the trip. It was awesome. Had a good time. Came back, and like, you know, in the weeks and months that followed, so that was kind of late May. So in early June there, and late, I don't know, sometime in the month of June, I kind of circled around with Dylan, and I was like, man, you know, I know we made this job offer in jest, but like, do you have a job? What are you going to do? And he didn't really have a job. He wasn't really sure. And I said, well, do you want to be a cameraman? Like, is this what you want to do with your career? Do you want to film and edit stuff? And he said, yeah, I do. And he said, I didn't know that was a possibility, but I've enjoyed what I've done with you guys. I really like taking pictures. Yeah, I think that's what I want to do for my career. I said, all right, well, would you consider moving? And he said, I live in the dorm, and I'm not going to live at my mom and dad's house, either one. And he said, so I got to move somewhere, and there's nothing really tying me to Missouri per se. And I said, well, tell you what, you would consider moving. I've got an empty house in Memphis. It's a rental house. And I said, it's right in the middle of town. You know, it's not like luxury, and it's not the worst hood in the world either. Why don't you move in? You can stay in this house and like go to work for me. He's like, really? I said, yeah, I mean, I can make the job offer that I wrote for you. Like, I know we made that kidding, but I can make that work. I got enough stuff to be done. I had some stuff around the clinic. We were developing the dog hotel at the time, and, you know, that business was growing, and I needed pictures and video and stuff for that. And I was thinking that whether it was a television show or something else, I didn't know what this was, but I was about to heavily invest Rolling Thunder resources into this marketing project. And so I knew I was going to need another cameraman. And he was like, man, I'll do that. That's fine. And so, man, drop of a hat, he packs his stuff and moves to Memphis. And bless his heart, he showed up. His dad and his stepmom and his girlfriend, and they showed up in two vehicles. And, I mean, he didn't have I don't think Dylan even had a bed. I think he had a mattress. He put the mattress on the floor, no couches, no furniture. I got him a washer and dryer and a refrigerator. But I mean, like 100% straight up bachelor pad. And he dove in and went to work. I mean, first day at work, we drove to the Apple store and told him, I said, I want the biggest, baddest, most powerful Apple laptop you got and all the editing software. And they fixed him up, and we kind of hit the ground. And But we still had no idea what we were doing project-wise. I was starting to kind of formulate it, but I just wasn't sure what to call it, what to do with it, and what it was going to be. So kind of first, I started formulating some ideas, and I'm kind of a big picture thinker. I think from big picture to details instead of from details to big picture. And that's just everybody's wired some way, right? Some people think from details to the big picture. I tend to think the other way, from big picture to details. So I thought about some things, and I had been thinking about some things for a television show, like how did I want it to be different? What did I want to be the distinctives of it, and what did I want to try to accomplish? And so what I wanted the distinctives of it to be was I wanted whatever we did in 5, 10, 15, 20 years, people to look back and say they made a difference in the industry. I wanted that to be a distinctive. I didn't want it to just be, you know, Spence's Adventures,
boom, boom, look shoot at me up.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want it to just be about, hey, look how much fun it is to be them. Not knocking anybody else's television show, but it's kind of a guiding principle, and it was kind of a guiding principle in the call company was, I tried from day one, I didn't name it Halford's Custom Calls or Halford's Poly Injected Molded Old Lookalikes. I mean, I intentionally didn't make the company about me. I wanted the company to have a life of its own. And so I named it something other than my own name. And I wanted the marketing project that we use to advance our brand to be similar. I didn't want it to just be Spencer's Adventures. I wanted it to be about something that people could watch and relate to and could learn from and be encouraged by. And ultimately, without like preaching at people, I wanted people to see the gospel of Jesus Christ displayed, you know, kind of in the way that we portrayed what we did. But I also wanted people to see and to be encouraged to be better humans and to be better hunters and to pass on a legacy. Like, those things mattered to me. And so if that was kind of a guiding principle, the other guiding principle was I really wanted these things to be cinematic and thoughtful and not just accidental. And I wanted them to be true to life. I wanted to keep it real, because all those things are really a reflection of who we are and the brand that we've created. They're the embodiment of all those things. So I cared about tying all that together, and I cared about the marketing project displaying those things. So I took those ideas, and I took, you know, the kind of this obvious direction away from television, from lack of funding and lack of interest among sponsors and just kind of all those bumps in the road. I took it and said, okay, we need to do something on social media instead of network television. So we started looking around at social media, and I said, who's doing something? You know, what can we look at and learn from? And the reality is there really weren't many. There have been a few little web series here and there, but none of them got the attention and the effort and the budget that television got. So the quality on social media tended to be really, in a lot of ways, subpar. There was a lot of awesome photography. There were a lot of awesome short 5, 10, 20 second video clips, but there were very few quality stories being told on social media about life, the hunting life, you know, hunting just in general. And so I thought, well, what if we took the quality in terms of cameras and editing from television, that, like, you know, the resources that gets devoted into a television show project, what if we took that and we did it in a cinematic, very thoughtful, very well organized manner, sort of like the Yeti and Sitka films and others that were doing short films. I didn't mean in just a second ago to imply that I created short films. I really was trying to say that I was comparing in terms of a series, you know, a multiple things in a project. I wasn't seeing that anywhere on social media. And so I thought, well, what if we took the best stuff from standalone short films that the Yetis and the Sitkas and the, I can't think of others, but there's a bunch of others that the standalone kind of stories that they're doing. What if we married that with all the best stuff from television? And what does television have to offer? Well, television is what marketing folk call a drip campaign, right? It's just like a constant dripping faucet. You're constantly putting new content out in front of people, and it's not just one single episode that impacts someone or causes a buying decision or causes a consumer reaction. It's the progressive effect over time of that campaign, you know, drip, 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 you know, boom, you just keep putting out episodes. And over time, you know, over 10 seasons, like RNTV, you've got this, you know, rabid following of Rich and Tone fans. And other brands have done that. I didn't develop that. But so I said, what if we took the best of both worlds, social media and network television, what if we took those two things and we married them together, what would that look like? And I said to Dawson and Dylan, like, this is kind of conceptually what I want to do. And let's sit down and meet, the three of us, in my office and with a whiteboard, and let's daydream about what this could be. Where could we go? What could we do? What stories could we tell? And I had a you know, notepad on my phone of just story ideas. This, like, the kind of stories that you would tell if you were sitting at hunting camp. You know, what are the you're sitting around, you know, and your dad or your grandfather or your uncle or whoever, you know, they tell a story, and it's like your favorite story, and every time you go to hunting camp, you hope that story gets told over and over. It could be the night the boat broke down and you end up sleeping in the woods all night and you nearly froze to death, or the day we shot 15 limits in 30 minutes, or whatever those epic stories are for people. Like, how can we tell those stories? What are our stories? And so we schedule a meeting, and now I got two cameramen, they both live in Memphis, and we're going to sit down and schedule these stories. And so I want to say that was like end of June, maybe it was the middle of July, sometime that summer. And I'll never forget, it was probably 9 o'clock in the morning. I told these guys, like, get up, you know, take a shower, brush your teeth, meet me at the office, act like you got a job and not like you're millennial bums. and they said, okay, met them there, sat down, and in the first thing, I mean, like, I shut the office door. We're actually in my dad's office. I didn't have an office at the time. Shut the door, and I sat down, and Dawson said, I need to talk first. And I said, okay. And he said, I've taken a full-time job. And,
oh man,
dude, my heart, like, fell out. I mean, snotty-nosed kid, like, in less than 2 years, I helped him freaking get a camera, rent lenses, like, we'd done all this stuff to kind of, I mean, he had just insane amount of talent, but, man, you know, Dawson learned a lot just by hanging out with us and sleeping on the couch, and he lived at duck camp for a whole year. And, I mean, here we are, like, I've finally gotten over all these hurdles of television show and blah, blah, blah. And, like, we're to this point where, okay, we're about to make the roadmap. Like, we're going to change the outdoor industry, man. We're going to change social media. We're going to bring the most, you know, kick-ass project to social media that the hunting industry's ever seen. And Dawson quits on day one. And, dude, I was so mad. And I mean, that created a whole year sort of, I was really upset with Dawson. I mean, I loved him, but I hated him all at the same time. And he went and worked for a creative company that he you know, had to do, I don't know, he did photography and video work, and he did a whole bunch of stuff for him. But so he walked out, and literally in the first planning meeting, it was just me and Dylan. And I walked into his truck, and I said, I mean, is your mind made up? You're done. Like, there's no talking you out of this. You know, he's like, yeah, I'm done. He was like, I love you, and I appreciate you, and I feel like I got this job because, you know, I worked for you last duck season, and of course, all of turkey season. And I was like, man, dude, I just feel like you cheated on me. And he was like, I kind of feel like that too. And that was the end of it. What were you going to say?
I think we've all been that at that point as employers, where we just feel like we have our part ripped out. And it's not, it's almost like a breakup with a high school sweetheart or something. You wish the best for them, but at the same time, you've got them in you've got people that are helping you out. Especially when you work together well, they know you know them. It's almost like a relationship with the lab. You're a hunting retriever.
Correct. It was more than just a work relationship because, I mean, Dawson had slept at my house a bunch of times. He literally slept on the couch at duck camp the entire season. That season I paid him for 47 days of the 60 in Arkansas, and he slept on the couch because we had 10 beds and we had 10 members. He wanted to sleep on the couch. That's where he likes to sleep when he goes somewhere. But Dawson slept on the couch because it was the only available spot, or he slept on the floor in front of the television. And so you're talking about, I mean, granted, he made chump change. And we worked as, you know, fingers to a nub, and I can only imagine the frustration of living with me and living with us, you know, through a duck season. So I don't blame him. I mean, he took what he really thought was going to be a career opportunity, but I mean, dang, it hurt. The boy quit college to work for us, to follow us around and to be a cameraman. And he drove to Hot Springs, Arkansas 2 days before he was catching an airplane to go to Canada to get his passport in person. Like, I felt like he was my kid, you know? I mean, I felt like I had personally invested so much into feeding him and clothing him and keeping him in waders and just making this whole thing work. And it was like, geez, we just finally got to the point where we're going to make this happen and you just quit. I was mad at him. I was hurt. My feelings were hurt.
He's been there since the beginning. He's almost like a founder without any financial investment into it.
Exactly. And he said, I was like, man, how could you leave now? And he goes, man, he said, I just couldn't bring myself to sit and brainstorm with you about a project that I knew I wasn't going to be working on. And he said, I just thought this was the right thing to do. And
there's a second part to this. Let me say this real quick before you jump off on that. The second part in that is when you have nothing and you're working together to make something, you really, really build a friendship with somebody. I've been two other business instances, and the same thing happened right before it explodes. You know, person walk away, and you're like, it's right here. Can't you see
right.
it?
Right. And there was, you know, there were lots of frustrations that I haven't adequately described. I mean, everything from, Dawson was a kid, and I didn't know what I was doing either. I mean, and so I'm sure that he deserved more money. I wish I had more money to pay him. He deserved better accommodations. I mean, there's a bazillion things that were frustrating to him about the gig and that I felt like we were about to all solve and vice versa. You know, there were things I was frustrated with him about, and it just is one of those things we had poured so much in a relationship, and it was just like, rip a Band-Aid off. And so I walked into the truck, let me keep going, and put him in the truck, and I turned around and I walked back inside and I sat down at the desk and I looked at Dylan and I was like, what the hell, man? And he just looked at me and he goes, I don't know. I don't know what to say. And we kind of chit-chatted and he said, I mean, Dylan doesn't say much. And I was just kind of dumbfounded. Like I had 3 pages of notes that I was wanting to brainstorm and talk about and, you know, spitball ideas. And Dylan just goes, man, it's going to be all right. Like, I got this, you know, we'll figure it out. We'll make it. And of course, in my mind, I'm like, yeah, right. You know, whatever. You don't have any idea what you're talking about, Dylan. You know, you just don't, like, okay, I appreciate that. But it felt very much like he was just trying to get me to calm down and not be upset. So we parted ways at that, you know, that morning, and we reconvened, I think, that afternoon or the next morning to start talking about ideas. And so basically my idea, the framework of the idea, the relationship that Dylan and I had at this point was I said, all right, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to give you a framework for what I want to create. And I want you to help put that into a movie or a video, into visual. And he said, okay. And of course we're talking here totally in abstraction. So I said, let's start with six. And there was a reason behind the number six, but, 6 waterfowl episodes, and let's make them about whatever we're doing at the time. Let's make them true to the time of year. Let's turn them around quick. So, you know, if we go to Canada in September, at the end of September or early October, let's turn it around in the month of October while everybody else is going to Canada or while everybody else is thinking about Canada. So if you're a duck hunter and you're in October, you're either going to Canada or you're wishing that you were in Canada. And the power in social media is in relevancy of the content and in immediacy of the content. And so those two principles we had noticed from everything I'd ever posted. Like if I killed a turkey and I posted at 8:30 or 9 o'clock that morning, you know, ding dong, the wicked witch is dead. You know, the beast is dead. Like that post would get hundreds of likes. But if I posted throwback Thursday 3 weeks ago, caught this one slipping, you got no interaction from people. And so it kind of, as we were both sort of, I had been over the last year kind of psychoanalyzing social media and looking and observing people's reactions. And then especially after that video about Trip, just kind of analyzing, we determined that immediacy and relevancy to the time of the year were the two most powerful things. Like an opening day pile of ducks picture on opening day got a zillion times more interaction than an opening day picture during the middle of the summer from 3 years ago. So I said, let's take those two guiding principles into our video project. So let's film something, edit it, turn it around, spit it back out quick. So like first week of September, we're going to shoot resident geese in Fayette County. That's what we always do. It lasts 15 days and we'll burn it up every day. It's all about scouting. It's all about hitting the road, finding geese, finding them feeding somewhere, going in the next morning, shooting them up. So video number one needs to be about the first thing we do each fall, which is kick it off with honker season and you know, as soon as corn gets cut. You know, episode two will be in Canada. We'll go to Canada after we do resident goose. And then, you know, 3, 4, 5, and 6, those will be about Arkansas because that's where we go after Canada. So we all, you know, no holds bar. We're public land duck hunters. So we kind of created this framework and we started thinking about these episodes. And I had it in my head that from what I had learned about television and creating television shows, I had it in my head that I needed 2 cameramen and I needed somebody to edit. And that whoever edited needed to be different than the cameramen. And the reason I thought that was because I had watched Dawson for a year. You know, you get up at 3:30 in the morning, you ride in, run the hole with everybody, You lay there for 2 hours waiting on daylight. You shoot your ducks. You're back at the, you know, at the camp by 10 o'clock. You eat lunch. You pass out for 4 hours. You wake up about 5:30, 6 o'clock. You might try to go, or 5 o'clock, you know, you might run out, try to watch a flight line or watch some, you know, some semblance of a scout mission. And you know, then you come back to the house, drink a beer, and then you just freaking pass out. Well, there's no time to edit in there. And to edit, you need to be awake. You need to be on a good night's sleep. You need to have a fresh, you know, eyes wide open. Like, you need to be energized. And editing is like painting a picture. You know, you don't just half-ass paint a picture. You don't half-ass create, you know, a sculpture if you're an artist. Like, and videographers are artists. Like, they not only take awesome shots, they have to spend a lot of time looking at the computer, developing that in post-production and adding music and trimming and cropping and coloring and all these things. Like, the whole editing process is, I mean, it's a whole life of its own. And so I learned that, and I thought, we need an editor. So
you, and okay, hold up. You got to have these guys on the same page. The thing exactly. about it is, all right. You've laid out a framework. You've got these stories that you want to tell.
Yep.
So how often did telling those stories work out? Because when you go into these stories, something else may come out of it. And then you're faced with, between your editor and your videographers, is the B-roll that you got to shoot to support
That's right.
the story.
That's right. So I'll tell you one short story. I know we're going forever today, but I'll tell you one short story and then I'll answer that question. So that was the purpose of that first meeting, was to get the team together. I wanted to get my creative guys together. I wanted to pitch them the framework, spitball ideas. And I wanted to explain to him that here's what's going to happen. I'm going to take y'all somewhere to do something. And I'm going to give you 100,000-foot view of what I want the storyline to be. Like, basically, let's just call that the clothesline or the curtain rod. And then y'all are going to take that high-level conceptual idea and y'all are going to fill in, color the picture with your cameras. And then I had a third guy who was going to edit it all. And he was insanely talented, great guy, had done a lot of television show, like a lot of television, young guy, but had done tremendous amount of television show work. So, I got all three of everybody together, Dawson Bales. So now I'm working with Dylan. I take Dylan. We meet with the guy who's going to do the editing. You know, we're all right. So the very first thing we're going to do, the very first episode, is we're going to call it Home. And in the first half of the episode, we're going to tell in 2.5 minutes the story of Rolling Thunder. Like, where did the call company come from? Who are we? And then make that like an introduction to the series. So we're going to tell the story of the call company in my garage and the kind of that sort of thing, and then we're going to transition into what we're doing, which is honker hunting that time of year, resident geese. So we film this stuff, and Dylan kind of chops up this introductory piece, which is me in the garage working in my shop, and has some voiceover in it, and you know, we kind of do the voiceover and Dylan, and we got to talking about it, and I was like, man, you know what would be really cool is, like, we're trying to figure out how to, again, we're thinking big picture, so we're trying to figure out how to not just make this a one-episode thing. How can we create something in an episode that has a life to it? And so, you know, we were like, we really didn't want to do a ton of sit-down interview stuff, so we were kind of leaning heavily towards a lot of voiceover, kind of the way Heartland Waterfowl does things. So if you're going to introduce something, have a voiceover in the background saying what's going on, but not have the camera right in somebody's face. Because, I mean, the reality is I'm ugly. I only got one good eye, and the last thing everybody needs to see is my bum eye in 4K HD, me saying, well, we're out here in Baller, Tennessee, and we got us a cut cornfield, and we're going to shoot some honkers today. So y'all stay with us, and we'll see if we can get it done. You know, we're trying to not be that, because that's what TV was. Nothing against TV, but we were just trying to be different. So we kind of got talking about this voiceover thing, and we're like, well, what if – I said to Dylan one day, I said, what if we did, like, we wrote in a journal, and the voiceover was kind of like the thoughts that were in my head? He was like, man, I think that would be really cool. And I said, I think that would be a way of me being able to say some things kind of to the industry or to the people that are watching without it coming across like I was standing on a soapbox and preaching to everybody, because I didn't want to just preach to everybody. But at the same time, I wanted to say things. There were a whole bunch of thoughts in my head that I wanted to say. I wanted to say things like, hey, be a good dad. You know, hey, take your kids hunting. Hey, make your wife important. You know, make your family more important than hunting. Go hunting all over the world, but don't be a good son. Use the outdoors to tell the people that mean the most to you that you care about them. And so I had all these, I literally had a list of all these kind of concepts that I wanted to try to convey, like life principles that I just felt like the good Lord was laying on my heart to share with people. And I wanted to do it in a way that wasn't like beating you over the head with a sledgehammer, hellfire and brimstone, you know, everybody bow their heads and close their eyes, and we're going to have an invitation, and, you know, you need to get more Jesus in your hunting. Kind of like, I didn't want it to come across like that. And so as we talked about it, it was like, man, a journal is a great idea, because you can kind of say anything you want to in a journal, and people will just say, well, you know, that's what's going on inside his head. And so there's a softer presentation method, right? So I'm getting to answer your question, I promise. We had all the blocks for episode one. We had all the stuff. We had the goose footage, and man, we had just absolutely ripped their heads off two or three times that spring. I mean, the best hunt, we shot them one
literally, morning. Literally and figuratively.
I mean, literally, like the best hunt that morning. We had a kid. It was one of my farmer buddies. His 10-year-old was there. We shot a couple of we shot a band. We shot 65 or 60, I can't remember. It was either 65, something like that, geese. I think it was 65, like 13 limits or something. In 50 minutes, I mean, at your feet, just as in your face, killing. I mean, we thought we were Jeff Oles. I mean, we just absolutely smashed the geese. My dad was there. Our farmer buddy was there. We had scouting footage. I was like, you know, welcome to the television show business. Like, we just knocked this out of the park. I don't know what's hard about this, but we just absolutely stomped these geese. And then Dylan had kind of done this intro thing. So we send it all off to the guy who's going to edit. And he turns it around, sends it back to us. And me and Dylan watched it in the parking lot of the clinic together. Like, we'd gone to lunch, we're coming back to the office, bloop, hits the email. I'm like, hey, let's watch this. So we dial it up on the iPad, you know, and the Wi-Fi. We watch it, we look at each other like,
yep, and that's where we're going to stop before next week. It's a great stopping point, Spence. You know, I don't think that people understand how difficult it is. And we can get back into my question next week between a videographer and the person that's putting these shows together, because the really high quality stuff that you're watching and that you like, if you go back and really pay attention to detail, the really has great B-roll or supporting footage to whatever the person's saying in that video.
Oh yeah. And let me just answer your question. I'll just spit it out. It never materializes. We always start with a plan, and so far, like, the plan never comes to fruition. You think it's going to be this, it ends up being something different. Now, sometimes it's like, okay, this one's going to be about Canada. Well, yeah, I mean, like, we go to Canada, it's about Canada. Okay, got that. But you think the storyline's going to be, you know, massive mallards in a dry field or what, you know, or white geese or, and then it ends up being completely different. And so it, like, the best laid plans, I mean, they always, it always materializes different, is to answer your question.
And I'm going to tell you something. If it's not planned or, and plans change when you get to the field and there's a better story, it really puts a, because editors are good at what they do. Videographers are good at what they do. And each have to have knowledge of each other's job a little bit. And
they don't know a lot. I mean, it's like they have to know what the other one's going to do. That's the truth.
That's right.
The videographer
falls apart.
What is the editor going to want me to get? And the editor has to think, what did the cameraman, what was happening that the cameraman was trying to get? Like, they have to both be anticipating. It's like a never ending, which came first, the chicken or the egg. They have to be anticipating what's coming next or what happened. And yet reacting at the same time. It's like, it's a very, very difficult combination of things.
Yeah.
And I will say,
I'll say this. Hold on. See if you agree with me on this. If they don't, and it doesn't work well together, you have poor shows.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and not necessarily just, I don't know, poor might not be exactly the right word to use, but you just get the same. You just get the same old stuff. You know, you get stuff that's just, it's not terribly entertaining, and it doesn't draw you in. It's not riveting, and those things, marginal, subpar, sloppy, like those things on social media get absolutely destroyed. Whereas on network television, they don't. Because when you watch a television show on TV, if you're bored, you just change the channel. You don't watch it with something at the bottom of the screen that tells you how many other people liked it, how many other people shared it, and how many other people commented on it. So when you watch something on social media, you're immediately immersed by both the content that you're watching and the reaction of the entire rest of the world. So you see a video that somebody shares and it's got a million views or 3 million views or whatever, like, you're gonna probably watch that until the very, very end. But you see one that says 1.2K, 10 likes, and something like that. Like, you're going to watch it for a few minutes if it's interesting. And if it's interesting, you'll keep watching. But if it's not, you're not like, eh. But if it's got 5 million views and you start in 10 seconds and it's 90 seconds, in your mind, and when I'm saying this, every one of you will agree, you've thought this. In your mind, you're thinking something's about to happen at the end of that thing. And so if it gets to 80 seconds and you hadn't seen something, you're like, why'd 5 million people watch this? You're staying for the last 10 seconds. Like, you're watching the whole dang thing. And so we knew that on the very front end, that social media was unforgiving. You had responses from people. You were going to get their comments, their reactions, and you couldn't hide behind, oh, you know, we did 12 episodes last year on television, and Paulson says that the ratings are whatever they are. Like, you know exactly what the ratings are, whether they're men, women, how old they are, and what state they live in. I mean, so social media is a two-edged sword, you know, in that way. Let me say one more thing, Rocky, and I'll stop talking for today. If you want to go back and watch these, I would highly recommend it. I'm really proud of the project that we did. I'm even more proud of the work that Dylan has done, because 90% of the episodes, 95% of the episodes have been him. Some of them have had Dolphins footage in them, but the first season pretty much was 100% Dylan with a few other shots from random camera guys, but he carried the weight of that first season. And I would recommend, if you want to watch it, download the Mossy Oak Go app. And the reason I would recommend it is twofold. One, Mossy Oak is my title and presenting sponsor, and they're awesome folks. But two, the Go app streams in 4K, It's the only streaming app that I know of in 4K. If you watch like the YouTube version on your television at home, it's not 4K, it's 1080, which 1080 is roughly a fourth of 4K. It's like 1K. And even if you watched all the episodes like on your cell phone or whatever, I would recommend, man, go back and watch those episodes on a big screen. You would not believe the detail and some of the stuff that he captured in both the first season and the second season, but the footage is unreal. And I can say that because I never once touched the camera with it working and any of it be used. I mean, it's unreal, especially the Canada stuff and the big Midwestern stuff, like the Kansas and Oklahoma stuff, because you can see so far. And the detail of those cameras is just, it's unreal. And the color and everything, you put that on a big screen and it'll blow your mind how much better of a viewing experience it is than your phone. And so, you know, if you don't have anything to do, get you a six-pack of beer and you'll need a case instead of a six-pack. But sit on the couch and download the Mossy Oak Go app and stream it on your television. It's well worth the watch.
Well, Spence, we will jump back into it next week. We'll jump back into it and find out what you thought about that first episode as it comes back from the editor. Kind of figuring where this is heading to, knowing a little bit about what's going on. So, we'll be back next week to talk about that. Spence, thank you again. We want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.